Hello and welcome to lesson number 6 in our series on contextual psychology. I'm Dr. Richard Nongard with FastCEUs.com, and today I'm going to focus on positive psychology. What do you mean by positive psychology? That's the number one question I get whenever I talk to other therapists about positive psychology who are not familiar with it. These are the ideas that have come primarily from Martin Seligman, who's a psychologist who was a past president of the American Psychological Association, and Hungarian psychologist Csikszentmihalyi. And the way they define positive psychology is this way. We believe that a psychology of positive human functioning will arise, which achieves a scientific understanding and effective interventions to build thriving individuals, families, and communities. What's awesome is that positive psychology over the past decade or so has been researched from an academic perspective, and it has moved into the category of an empirically based treatment approach. Positive psychology is really the antithesis of our traditional approaches, which are pathological orientation. Rather, positive psychology looks at what is right rather than what is wrong. It is primarily concerned with using the psychological theory and research and intervention techniques to understand the positive, adaptive, creative, and emotionally fulfilling aspects of human behavior. In other words, instead of saying, oh my gosh, you know, what's wrong with you? Look at all of these horrible things that have happened. Positive psychology says, wow, what have you done to survive? It's remarkable that you've made it in light of all of these difficulties to the point that you have. It really is a complete change of pace from the traditional model of psychology, which is very problem-oriented. I remember back in the probably the late 1980s, learning what a psychosocial evaluation was and writing my first psychosocial evaluation. Back then, you know, we had to write 20 or 25 pages. That was before computers, so probably had to write most of them by hand since I didn't know how to type very well. And boy, they were just these huge, you know, we spend 2 hours interviewing a new client. This was an inpatient treatment. And then write 20, 25 pages about all of the problems they had. What were their legal problems, political problems, health problems, family problems, sexual problems, emotional problems, problems. And the last question on the psychosocial evaluation was always, what are the client's strengths? By the time you got to the last question on the psychosocial evaluation, you were so tired of writing and so tired of interviewing that you'd write something just to fill in the blank. They have cool shoes or nice hair and you'd move on. It occurred to me early on, though, that this was actually the most important question on the psychosocial evaluation. And so I moved my, what are the client's strengths, from the end of the evaluation to the top of the evaluation. It became the first question. And over the years, it's really become the only question that I concern myself with. My intake form in my office is very, very short. It's about 2 pages long, and actually it's double spaced and in 14 point font so that those who have difficulty seeing can easily read what's on the intake form. And so the intake form really doesn't have very many questions on there. And the reason why is because I'm really uninterested in what's wrong with my clients. I use predominantly approach based in the methods of positive psychology as articulated by Seligman and Csikszentmihalyi. Positive psychology is not, you know, Norman Vincent Peale and the Power of Positive Thinking. There's nothing wrong with, you know, Robert Schuller or Norman Vincent Peale and the positive, you know, the Power of Positive Thinking. It is instead concerned with psychological theory, research, and intervention, and researching those techniques which are adaptive, positive, creative, and emotionally fulfilling, rather than simply platitudes. Positive psychology is not about ignoring the existence of problems. Rather, it's about recognizing that some of my clients' problems are so catastrophic, there is probably zero that can be done in the context of therapy. And for most of my clients, as we've already discussed, those problems are a result of their histories, and history can never be changed. Positive psychology is not a simplistic approach. There are volumes of research that have been written. The other day, sitting on my desk, was a book. I must have misplaced it right now, but it's the Handbook of Positive Psychology, and it is just a tremendous resource, hundreds and hundreds of pages of techniques, ideas, and strategies that are all based in the research. It is not an experimental process. It has moved into the category of evidence-based treatment. You can go to scholar.google.com and you can type in positive psychology, and you can find a tremendous amount of research on the applications of these approaches to a wide variety of conditions. Also, I want to make clear that when we're talking about positive psychology, we are not talking about the theory of the law of attraction or positive confession. In the current era, I know that there was a popular movie a couple of years back called The Secret, and you only think positive things and you only attract positive things. That's not what positive psychology is all about. It is not a fad. It is based, again, on psychological theory, research, and intervention to help us understand positive, adaptive, creative, and emotionally fulfilling aspects of human behavior. It is a non-pathological model or approach, kind of like PI, persons and environment. It identifies the strengths or resources. It recognizes that it's a lot easier to use the strengths and the resources that exist within a client than it is to create new strategies that to this point have not yet existed. And almost every one of my clients, in fact, I can honestly say in all of the clients I've ever worked with, although many of them have had tremendous problems, I've never met anybody yet who had no strengths and no resources to draw from. They may have been limited. They might not have known how to use them. But every client I've ever worked with has had strengths and resources available to them. Positive psychology is a set of strategies that can be applied both to individuals and to families, as well as organizations. The outgrowth of the positive psychology movement has been probably larger than the initial awareness in the 1980s of positive psychology, and that is through an application of positive psychology to community development, for those of you who are social workers or ministers, as well as to business consulting for those who may be doing corporate consulting or organizational psychology. That process is known as appreciative inquiry. And appreciative inquiry has been utilized with community service organizations, as well as huge multinational corporations. One group in Phoenix, Arizona, social service agency called Neighborhood Ministries, a small agency, I think they have a $2 million annual budget, give or take, has used appreciative inquiry as a process for developing the community at 19th and Van Buren over the last 30 years with tremendous success and efficacy in their work. British Airways used, after September 11th, appreciative inquiry as a process for changing their organizational culture and experiencing financial success in a time where many airlines, particularly international airlines, were having tremendous difficulty. People are familiar with the corporate story of Jack Welch and General Electric, and appreciative inquiry was used as a consulting process with all of the employees of General Electric during Jack Welch's tenure. So positive psychology has applications far beyond individual therapy. I'm going to restrict my discussion here today to the methods and techniques that we would use in counseling and social work, with individuals and families who are in our office. But recognize that appreciative inquiry is the flip side of the coin from an organizational perspective, and spending some time Googling appreciative inquiry and learning about its applications as a problem-solving technique based on the psychological principles of positive psychology, Seligman and Csikszentmihalyi, has yielded fantastic results. Positive psychology is a non-threatening approach. It doesn't seek to embarrass or humiliate by exposing what is vulnerable and what is wrong, but instead by valuing what is right. It is motivational. And the great thing for those who are therapists following a coaching model is that ultimately it seeks the highest level of performance. The word associated with positive psychology and primarily Csikszentmihalyi's work is flow. And flow is being in that zone of happiness. A lot of happiness research has been done in the last several years by those interested in positive psychology. Positive psychology is really concerned with three main issues: positive emotions, positive individual traits, and of course, positive institutions. There is an acronym in positive psychology, just like ACT therapy and many of the other contextual therapies, and that acronym is PERMA. These really are the goals of positive psychology as articulated by Martin Seligman. I like having an acronym to help us identify the goals of a therapeutic protocol. The reason why is this tells me what it is that I should be shooting for in my therapy with clients. And so the P stands for positive emotions, feeling good, however it is that our client defines that. And Seligman in particular has done a tremendous amount of research into happiness. And if you go to scholar.google.com and you type in Martin Seligman and happiness, you can find a lot of research about what happiness is and why it is that some people are happy and other people are not, and how to help people become happy, which Csikszentmihalyi would actually refer to as flow. The E stands for engagement. Our goal in therapy is to help our clients to become completely absorbed in the activities that promote flow or health or wellness. The R stands for relationships. And while the internet through social media can give us connections to perhaps more people in the current era than we ever could have connected to in the past, the reality is authentically connected to others is the key in positive psychology. And the techniques of positive psychology are designed to support that goal of an authentic connection to others. I've always said that isolation breeds and brings weirdness. That my clients who've had the most difficulties are those who maybe through their own behavior have alienated others. That certainly is true with the addicts that I work with. But teaching our clients and working with our clients to help them authentically connect to others, to develop the skills for either assertive communication or risk-taking that are necessary for success, are really foundations of positive psychology. The M stands for meaning. Just like Stephen Hayes identified a valued path, Seligman and Csikszentmihalyi discuss purposeful existence. Achievement is the letter A. This is really about a sense of accomplishment and success. We all need to feel that we are valued, that we have accomplished something, that we are successful. Think about the important life events that you've had. Those life events are probably things that have been related to your own personal success or an accomplishment. Building a new home, graduating from college, doing whatever it is that you did that brought you a sense of achievement. Have you ever won an award for anything? We value that sense of accomplishment and success, and it's not enough to simply make change without deriving a sense of accomplishment and success from that change. The hallmarks of positive psychology include self-efficacy. This is really the belief that in one's own ability to accomplish a task, and it's a function of personal effort, their own ability to accomplish something. Self-efficacy is important. In fact, at fastcus.com, one of our continuing education courses is on self-efficacy. There are a number of strategies that we can use with clients to help them create a sense of self-efficacy, that not only have they accomplished something, but it was through their own efforts that they've done this. One of the other hallmarks of positive psychology is personal effectiveness. This is primarily concerned with planning and the implementation for methods of accomplishing those things that are important to them. And flow, flow is that state of absorption where one's abilities are well matched to the demands at hand. Flourishing, although the concept is tied to Seligman, Fredrickson gives us a great definition. It is the optimal human functioning. It comprises four parts: goodness, creativity, growth, and resilience. Now think about the counseling that you've been doing over the last 5 or 10 or 15 years. In your office, when clients are with you, is it focused on goodness? Is it focused on creativity? Is it focused on growth? Is it focused on resilience? Or has much of that counseling been negative, trying to, sure, we may have a positive approach to it, we're trying to solve, but the main focus has been on what's wrong. Positive psychology helps us to flourish in therapy by focusing on optimal human functioning rather than what has been wrong. A key element of positive psychology is, like other contextual psychologies, mindfulness, intentional, focused awareness on one's immediate experience, and also on elevation. Elevation is defined as a pleasant moral emotion involving the desire to act morally and to do good. Those of you who are familiar with Kohlberg's stages of moral development, that highest level of moral development. And elevation is something that we strive to accomplish in positive psychology so that we can achieve our highest level of potential. That's really different than most approaches in therapy, which in the current era of limited time and limited resources and managed care, try to help people move from a pre-crisis level of functioning back to an adequate level of functioning. By employing approaches of positive psychology, we can move people to elevation. And for me as a professional, probably for you as a professional too, when you go home at the end of the day having elevated people rather than simply supporting people, it makes a huge difference in our feeling of our own self-efficacy, personal effectiveness, flow, flourishing, and mindful awareness. Positive psychology, to accomplish these things, really asks the question differently than in traditional therapy. In traditional therapy, we usually ask the question, how can the client become less depressed? Or how can the client become less anxious? Or how can the client become less angry? In positive psychology, we say, although the client is angry, he's experienced happiness, or let's do the opposite of anger. Although the client is angry, he's experienced serenity before. The question is not how can we stop anger, but how can we increase serenity? So the therapeutic approaches are about increasing serenity, not about decreasing anger. Instead of asking our client, what can you do so that you're not depressed? We would ask our client instead, what can you do to feel happy? It really switches out the questions and has them operate from the other side of the pool table. Some of the specific methods of positive psychology include, of course, teaching our clients positive thoughts, how to reframe thoughts, how to find that which is positive. One of my favorite approaches is with clients who've come in who are depressed, who say, I can't be happy. I've had lots of clients over the years say, I can't be happy. And I've asked those clients to actually bring in, I'll say to my client, you know, a lot of people in their house have sort of a book, an album, a photo album of maybe a baby book or a family photo album or something like that. Could you bring that into your next session? And then when they come into that next session, I'll go through the pictures with them. And there might not be many pictures where they look happy, but I have always found at least one picture where a client looked happy. And I'll say, it's amazing. In this picture, you look happy. What was going on here? And they'll say, you know what? That was the last time I was happy. It was 28 years ago, but it was on that day because this is what happened. This is what happened. This is what happened. Now, we know that even though you're not happy, you have the capacity to be happy. We know that because you've been happy in the past. So now the question is, not why is it that I can't ever be happy, but how is it that I can increase happiness than I've felt before. I teach my clients the art of using affirmations. I'm going to spend some time in this workshop teaching you those specific methods. And I think affirmations are often overlooked as too simplistic, but they are extremely effective. And the reason why is simple. Anybody who's been practicing cognitive behavioral therapy knows that we need to counter cognitive errors. The most effective way to counter cognitive errors is with the truth. And those truths can become affirmations. In the 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, etc., one of the things that you'll sometimes see driving on a car down the street are these shiny bumper stickers, just for today, one day at a time. Those are affirmations. And those affirmations have become one of the most important elements of the success of 12-step programs. Why? Because they are effective counters to cognitive errors. People always say, in cognitive behavioral therapy, how do you counter the cognitive errors? It may sound simple, but it's effective. Use affirmations. Have your clients write them out. In fact, none of my clients ever leave my office without this set of instructions. In fact, I give them a dry erase marker. The reason why, most people don't have a dry erase marker at home, and so I actually keep them in my drawer and I give them to clients. And I'll say, take this dry erase marker at home and I want you to write the counter to your cognitive error. I don't say it like that, but that's what I'm having them do. Write this positive affirmation. Write down this truth. I'll write it on the bathroom mirror. What happens is, in their own handwriting, staring them back in the face in the morning, at night, the first thing and the last thing we see at the during the day is usually that bathroom mirror, is the counter to the cognitive error. And it can really become a powerful technique, a simple technique, for helping our clients make change. If you don't have a drawer full of dry erase markers, go, you know, buy them in bulk from an office supply store. You can probably buy 24 of them for $24. Give this assignment to your next 24 clients, and then tell me what happened when your clients actually did that. I'm not talking about a metaphor here. You know, imagine writing on your bathroom mirror what it would be like if you confronted yourself. I'm telling you to ask your clients to actually literally do that. Follow up. Make sure they wrote the counters to their cognitive errors, positive affirmations, on their bathroom mirror. And I guarantee you, even if they don't believe it when they wrote it, they will test the affirmation to find if it's true. And it will almost always, in the clients who we're working with, result in dramatic change. Within positive psychology is another acronym, and that is the APE method. And really, this is just an approach to questioning with clients, where we're going to search for alternatives. For example, more accurate way of seeing this is, let the client fill in the blank. Perspective. This, again, deals with altering their perceptual position, whether or not they're enmeshed in the feelings at the time. The most likely thing to happen is fill in the blank, and I can blank. Asking for them to share what response they can take in regards to a perceptual position. And then evidence. You know, in cognitive behavioral therapy, we learn to confront. And confrontation is really an important strategy in therapy. The E in APE stands for evidence. Ask for it. Challenge and confront those cognitive errors, taking the negatives and asking them to be reframed as positives. Some of the ways that we can help clients to develop positive emotion include scaling emotions into a Likert scale. This has really been a pretty powerful technique for me in my work with my clients. Almost all my clients come in and they're either angry or depressed or anxious. They've never learned that they're actually anxious at a level 8, or depressed at a level 6, or angry at a level 7. The Likert scale is a scale that measures of equal intervals on a scale of 1 to 10. We're all familiar with the Likert scale, even if we didn't know its name. And the simple technique of asking clients, when they give us an adjective that describes their emotion, to put that into a Likert scale, to give it a number, is a real powerful phenomena for helping our clients to scale their emotions into perspective. If you've ever had a client who makes a mountain out of a molehill, or makes a molehill out of something that ought to be a mountain. That was often the case when I worked in with offenders in the criminal justice community supervision setting. Scaling emotions into a Likert scale can be a real useful tool. Another idea for helping our clients to develop positive emotions is to help them become aware of coexisting emotional awareness. When they tell us how they feel, what else do you feel? And what else do you feel? Is there another word that describes how you feel? Ask our clients to identify coexisting emotional awarenesses. Many of our clients are actually unaware that depression and happiness can coexist, or that anxiety and acceptance can coexist. But when we ask them to practice identifying coexisting emotional awarenesses, our clients easily see that while they may in fact be depressed, they were missing that part of them that is happy. One of the primary methods for helping my client become skilled at doing that is to help them learn adjectives that describe human emotions. I find that many of my clients have a limited repertoire of words to describe how it is that they feel. I used to have a list. I wish I still had it. This was back in the day of photocopies, before we had email and, you know, things we could store forever on the hard drive. And I actually had a multi-page list. It was stapled together. It was probably about 4 pages front and back. 645 adjectives to describe human emotions: exuberant, excited, euphoric, you know, exhausted, exaggerated. I mean, all these different words to describe human emotions. And sometimes I would actually take those to group therapy and just have the group take turns reading some of those adjectives from the list, just to help them develop a greater repertoire of adjectives to describe emotions, because that helps my clients to see that there are multiple feelings to pick from. Unfortunately, I gave away the original in a group therapy probably about 20 years ago, and I've never recreated the list. But if anybody wants to earn extra credit, if there was such a thing, I'd appreciate it if you'd send me a copy. The fourth idea for scaling emotions or developing positive emotion is really a technique from neuro-linguistic programming called a state control pattern. What I'm talking about here is not Arkansas, Missouri, or New York. What I'm talking about in regards to NLP states are the experience of an emotion. It's more than just a descriptor of an emotion, but a praxeological vantage point of what it is that they're feeling at that time. And my clients don't know something. They don't know that they actually have the same pants to get glad in that they have to get mad in. And so I literally practice with my clients, helping them to develop a state, a resource state, in my office. For example, if the resource state is serenity, I'll take 5 minutes with them and help them become aware of serenity, amplify that sense of serenity, increase the feeling of serenity, or whatever positive emotion it is. And then teach my client that if they were able to create that here in my office, they can actually take it to go, and they can recreate that anywhere they'd like to. Seligman gives us an exercise called Three Good Things. It's really a journaling exercise. He asks his clients each night before they go to sleep to cultivate the practice of identifying those things which are positive. And so think of three good things that happened today. Write them down in your journal. And then a paragraph or two reflecting on why did those good things happen. What we have here when a client keeps a journal like this is that at the end of 30 days or 6 weeks, 45 days, our client actually has in their own hand their own recipe book of strategies to help them create good things. And these become the resources that have come from within the client rather than things that I've given to the client. And they become essentially a recipe book or a resource book for those clients. And in doing these things, we want to create positive habits. One of our goals in positive psychology is to teach our clients that they can accomplish something, and because they can accomplish this, they can accomplish that. Baumeister actually tells us, if you can do anything that requires self-regulation, then that makes it easier for you to have self-regulation in everything else. So, for example, if you have a client who comes in and says, I need help. I am a pathological gambler. I have no ability to self-regulate. I go down to the casino every time I get paid and I blow all my money. Or you have somebody who comes in and says, I'm a sex addict. My marriage is over. My life is out of control. I've been impulsive sexually and I don't seem to be able to stop no matter what I do. The basic psychological principle that Baumeister argues is that when we can develop self-regulation in one area, then like a muscle, when we work that out and practice self-regulation, it becomes something that's strong that we can actually apply in any situation. And so it turns out that our grandmother was actually correct. Sit with correct posture. Hold your head up. Put your shoulders back. Hold your tummy in. Good posture. It's important. But of course, good posture is one of those things that takes self-regulation. So I might have a client who comes in with a gambling compulsivity or sexual compulsivity or really any other of the impulse disorders, ranging from trichotillomania to kleptomania. And I might actually work with them during the session to cultivate a positive habit, to learn how to self-regulate something as mundane as posture in my office. Because if the client can master that, they've really worked out that self-regulation muscle, and they'll be able to apply the strength of that muscle either consciously or subconsciously to any other area of life where they may have found themselves experiencing difficulty. Now, back in the 80s, Stuart Smalley, a character on Saturday Night Live, used to sit in front of the mirror and say, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. That was his self-affirmation to himself. It was a Saturday Night Live skit that really spoofed self-help programs and the whole affirmation movement. I actually love affirmations. I think that they can be a tool in positive psychology. I think that Stuart Smalley may have been funny, but Stuart Smalley actually got it correct. It's a great way to confront our cognitive errors. At the current time, our cultural awareness of the value of affirmations has moved beyond Stuart Smalley to the Law of Attraction and The Secret, and you may recognize some of these phrases, like attracts like. Or maybe this one that your grandmother told you, birds of a feather flock together. Or this one, it is done unto you as you believe. These are examples of affirmations, and there seems to be in pop culture right now, probably in large part because of that movie, The Secret, a renewed interest in affirmations. Now, at the beginning of this workshop, I said, positive psychology is not the Law of Attraction or The Secret. It's not. It really has nothing to do with it. But because our pop psychology culture is aware of that movement, when we ask our clients to learn skills related to affirmations, they are going to relate it to this. And I think it's okay if our client comes to us with a set of experiences or knowledge or beliefs to actually utilize that. Of course, there are a lot of clients who have never heard of The Secret. Maybe you've never even heard of it, and that's fine. I'm not really sure that was worth watching. But a lot of my clients are familiar with the power of the word from their study of the biblical creation account. It begins, of course, in Genesis with God speaking. And this creation story is reflected both in Christian tradition as well as the stories of other cultures. In Buddhism, one aspect of the Eightfold Path called the Samavaka is often translated to English as right speech. But a more accurate rendering is wise speech or even skillful speech, which helpfully suggests speech that is acquired through practice. Not only does pop culture, whether it's Saturday Night Live or The Secret, or a Buddhist or Christian or other religious scriptures talk about the power of the spoken word, philosophers and metaphysicians in the past 100 years have written profoundly on this subject. Charles Hanel, who was an industrialist, the founder of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper, wrote, "Thought is energy. Active thought is active energy. Concentrated thought is a concentrated energy. Thought concentrated on a definite purpose becomes power." And Charles Hanel, 100 years before The Secret movie was ever produced, really understood the essence of this aspect of the spoken word. William Walter Atkinson, a metaphysician and philosopher from the early 1900s, wrote, "The best way to overcome undesirable or negative thoughts and feelings is to cultivate the positive ones." Now we can move in history here to the present time, or recent history. Sports Psychology Journal in 1991 published an article that was fascinating. They found that healing from injury most significantly correlated to goal setting, positive self-talk, and the use of healing imagery. In the book I wrote a few years back titled Medical Meditation, I utilized the techniques of goal setting, positive self-talk, and healing imagery as aspects of promoting wellness, whether it was a sports injury or any other kind of injury. When I work with clients to help them utilize positive affirmations because of their power, we see that in pop culture, we see it in religion, we see it in philosophy, I use 5 P's. I encourage my clients to write down their affirmations, to keep them in the present, to make them positive, personal, proactive, and to be passionate about those positive affirmations that they write. When I'm talking to my clients, I help them elicit the affirmations rather than giving them their positive affirmations. They will tell us when we listen to what affirmations they need to make. On my intake form, one of the questions I do have is, I do not have list 3 problems that brought you here today, but I do have list 3 strengths that you have. And I'll use those strengths as a basis for eliciting affirmations. We're going to talk in a subsequent lecture on solution-focused brief therapy and the miracle question. So if you've taken a course on solution-focused brief therapy and you know what the miracle question is, from the answer, that is a great place to write affirmations. If you don't know what the miracle question from solution-focused brief therapy is, don't worry, we'll get to it later on. We can elicit affirmations from our clients by reversing their deficits or their presenting problems. And when I train clients in using positive affirmation, I encourage them to speak their positive affirmations, to write them down, to put them on yellow stickies, or to use a dry erase marker and write them on the bathroom mirror. I ask my clients to put them on a screensaver on their computer. You can create your own screensaver in about 2 minutes nowadays. Affirmations can be shared as a Facebook status. It's amazing how the social reinforcement, the likes that a client receives in response to posting a positive affirmation, can make that affirmation come alive. And interestingly enough, there's actually a ton of research showing that that's true. That likes are a very important part of psychological phenomena. Affirmations can be recorded by my clients as an MP3, something they can use as part of a meditation or really any other aspect of repetition. There are some recommended readings for today's lecture that I think would be useful to you. There really are a ton of books, but the 2 that I would recommend are Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience by Csikszentmihalyi. That's how you actually say that name, in case you're wondering. How do you pronounce that? It's a Hungarian name, and I speak enough Russian to get around that I'm actually familiar enough with the pronunciation of some of these Eastern European names that I can actually get them correct every once in a while. Another great book is called Flourish, A Visionary New Understanding of Happiness and Well-Being by Martin Seligman. And it is, I think, one of those books that belongs in every mental health professional's library. I'm looking forward to seeing you in our next session. I hope today's lecture was useful to you. The assignment, because every one of these lectures, or almost every one of these lectures, has an assignment, is real simple. Take out a pad of yellow stickies and write some positive affirmations for yourself using these guidelines. Perhaps if you're a therapist who also journals, as I recommend, you can use the three good things journaling format that Seligman offers us between now and next week. Either one of those assignments will be fine. Either one of them will reinforce your learning. And I'm glad that you've participated in today's session on positive psychology.